So our second reading picks up in Job chapter 1, verse 13, so page 498. So we began this new series in Job last week. So our first reading was just a refresher of what we looked at last week. And we pick up the story in 1:13. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, then another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground and he worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he's in your hand. Only spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and he struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. At a previous church I worked for, one of their mission partners was a couple called James and Barbara Sherwood. They were serving in Africa with a Christian organization called the Navigators. One day, armed robbers came to their house, and James was shot in the face at pretty much point-blank range through the front door, and his wife Barbara was assaulted. And amazingly, this guy James survived, although half his face had to be reconstructed through umpteen operations. And they're still serving the Lord today, many years later. A story like that raises at least two questions. First, what would happen to your faith in God, if you experienced a tragedy like that yourself? So maybe not armed robbers coming to your door, but a devastating diagnosis. Or you never got the job, or the child, or the spouse you longed for. Or you got them and they were taken away from you. What would it do to your faith in God? Would you hold on to God, or would you turn against God? These are the questions the book of Job forces us to consider. So that's the first one. The second one is, how do we make sense of a story like the Sherwoods? It doesn't seem to make sense. So if God is loving, surely he wouldn't want that to happen to his people. And if he is all-powerful, surely he could stop it happening. So why did it happen? And these are questions to which the book of Job gives us some answers. So the book of Job gives us a glimpse of how things in heaven shape events here on earth. The book of Job, as we learned last week, is not about suffering in the world in general. It is about a suffering believer. So Job, we learned, is a model believer, a righteous man. But Satan accuses him before God. He accuses him of being a fair-weather believer who only worships God when the sun is shining and who will curse him if the storm clouds come and his material blessings are taken away. And so we saw last week that God allows Satan to cause Job to suffer. It's a test. It's a test that will prove whether or not his faith is genuine. And so our passage last week, which was our first reading today, it ended with Satan going out from the presence of the Lord to launch his attacks on Job. And that is what we're looking at now. Two terrible days in the life of this believer. So 1:13 says, now there was a day, and 2:1, again, there was a day. So let's look at the first assault by Satan. So if you've got it open there, 1:13. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. So it starts as just another normal day for Job. Life is good for this happy, wealthy believer. So his 10 children, they're having another of their parties, their celebrations at the house of the oldest son. Job is at home with his wife, and maybe he's just had lunch, and his favorite praise song is playing away in the background. But unknown to him, his world is about to collapse around him. And that is the point about tragedy, that it can come out of left field. Everything's going fine, and then suddenly the phone rings, or there's a knock at the door, and the bottom falls out of your world. And so if life is good at the moment, do not think that this story is irrelevant to you. Job's story can become our story in an instant. You never know what the next day will bring. On this particular day, the doorbell rings at the Job residence, and maybe he assumes it's just the Ocado delivery driver, but instead he finds on the doorstep this out-of-breath messenger. Verse 14, there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing, donkeys feeding beside them, the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them, struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, I alone have escaped to tell you. It's like a terrorist attack today. These armed raiders have taken all his 500 yoke of oxen, all 500 donkeys, killed the servants who were looking after them. One sole survivor. Job is still reeling from the shock when another messenger arrives. Verse 16, while he was still speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven, burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I alone have escaped to tell you. So now he's lost all 7,000 sheep and more of his servants. And again, a sole survivor. This time, notice, it was due to a natural disaster. Fire from heaven, maybe lightning. Well, by now the color would have drained from Job's face. But this third messenger arrives, verse 17. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups, made a raid on the camels, took them, struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. So another attack by armed raiders. So now his 3,000 camels have gone, plus all the servants. Again, a sole survivor. So now he's bankrupt, yet he's lost everything he owned. So this man who was the greatest of all the people of the East has gone from riches to rags in a single day. Be like a modern-day multimillionaire losing every penny, just like that. But the day isn't over, and worse is yet to come. So verse 18, while he was still speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house, it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Many years ago, I had a phone call saying that my father had died. Many years after that, another phone call saying my mother had died. But imagine getting a phone call saying that all your 10 children have died. Crushed under the rubble when their house collapsed in a hurricane. There was a day when Job's world caved in. Two terrorist attacks, two natural disasters, and he's lost everything. What is this teaching us? Well, first, that very bad things may happen to God's people, to faithful, godly believers. Very bad things may happen, not because of sins they have committed or mistakes they've made, but for other reasons. And it's so important to realize this, because if we are faithful believers like Job, it does not mean that everything in life is going to work out. And we need to build that into our framework of expectation and understanding. Second lesson, Satan has more influence than perhaps we thought. What can Satan do? We'll all be familiar, I guess, with the idea that, he's the tempter who tempts us to sin. And Satan is the deceiver who tries to deceive us through false teaching. He tries to take us away from the truth. But his influence goes way beyond that. These terrorist attacks, these natural disasters, so-called, they were his doing. We know that, don't we, from verses 6 to 12 of chapter 1, that God had placed all that Job had in Satan's hand, and these disasters were the result. Satan was directly responsible. So the armed raiders were sent by him. The fire and the storm, it was his doing. The deaths of Job's servants and his children were caused by him. And so Satan does not just operate in the spiritual realm. He has power in the physical realm too, in events, in circumstances, in our lives. I don't think this changes with the New Testament, as far as I can tell. So Revelation 2 verse 10, I put in the footnotes. John is writing to the church in Smyrna, and he says this: the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. The devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. The devil has that kind of power to throw believers into prison. Or Revelation 13 verse 10 says that the beast was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. 1 Thessalonians 2:18, Paul says that Satan hindered us from coming to the church in Thessalonica. So we should not assume that everything that happens in our lives is God's direct doing. Although God is sovereign, some bad things that happen to us may be the work of the devil. Third point is that the sovereign God allows Satan to have this influence. So Satan only has this power by God's permission. As in that verse I just read from Revelation 13, it says, the beast was allowed, i.e. by God, was allowed to make war on the saints. And so here in Job, God is sovereign, he alone is all-powerful, he is in control, but he allowed Satan to do these things, these evil things. And one reason is to test us as believers and show our faith is genuine. In the Harry Potter film, do you remember the final battle at Hogwarts Castle? So the defenders, they conjure up this magic dome, don't they, to be a sort of protective shield over the castle. And when that is in place, that protective dome, those inside the castle are safe. But you may remember that eventually the dome is brought down by that nasty guy Voldemort, and then the invaders could storm the castle. Well, God had placed that kind of protective dome, protective shield, over Job and all Job had. And Satan referred to that in chapter 1, verse 10, as a hedge, basically a protective shield. But on this fateful day, God switched off the shield and he allowed Satan to attack Job's world to test his faith. And he may do that to us too. I think when I was a younger Christian, I assumed that if I was faithful to God, then his protective shield would always cover me, and that would mean that life would always work out. But that is not true to life, and that is not true to the Bible. This passage helps us to make better sense of life. I was thinking about this, reflecting on, as I mentioned in the previous week, our car hassles in Sweden this summer when our car broke down. We had a week of hassle and stress trying to work out how on earth we were going to get back to the UK. Massive expenses, the car's still stuck over there in Sweden somewhere. And you think, why? You know, what on earth is going on? And I find the perspective of a passage like this actually helps. I mean, why did it happen? I mean, it could just be, you know, it's life, isn't it? Cars break down, that happens. Or was it Satan's doing? Did God allow it to test our faith? It's certainly possible from a passage like this, and I think understanding that can help us in responding rightly. Now, Job had no idea about Satan's involvement, but still he responded, didn't he, with amazing faith after he lost a lot more than his car. So verse 20, then Job arose and tore his robe and he shaved his head. So he grieves, he mourns, and he fell on the ground and he worshipped. What a guy. What amazing faith to respond like that when you've lost everything. Verse 21, and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. We arrive in this world with nothing. So when Lucas Gosler was born last week, this isn't him, by the way. He emerged into the world stark naked, I take it. No clothes, no possessions, nothing. And when one day we leave this world, we leave with nothing. We leave behind all our possessions, all our money, all our relationships. And what that means is that whatever we have in between those two events, in between our birth and our death, whatever we have are undeserved, gracious gifts from God. The Lord gave. And as God, he has the right not just to give gifts to us, but to take gifts back from us. The Lord has taken away. Having this perspective on life enabled Job to worship God even when he lost everything. And it will help us too when we face loss. To see that everything we have, it's a gracious gift from God, and he does not owe us anything. And so if God chooses to withhold or to take back some of these gifts, for whatever reason, he is entitled to do that. And genuine faith still worships him, still blesses his name, doesn't turn against him, doesn't accuse him of wrongdoing. And such faith brings glory to God because it says he is worthy and we love him, not just because of what he gives us, but for who he is. My cousin Jonathan and his wife, whom I mentioned last week, they got up at the funeral service of their 16-year-old boy, Freddie, and they testified to their ongoing faith in God, even in the face of this inexplicable loss. And it was profoundly moving. I mean, they, They weren't making out all is fine, far from it. They were devastated, they were bewildered, they were hurting, they were bereft, but they were hanging on to God in it all. And that is what genuine faith does. And by contrast, if we have, as we were thinking last week, if we have a vending machine faith, that is when we start laying into the machine with a sledgehammer. If we're rice Christians, as we were thinking last week, that is when our faith is exposed for the superficial thing it is, and we take off. The Swedish director, film director, Ingmar Bergman, he made a film called Summer Interlude, and it's sort of typically bleak, Scandi stuff. In it, there's this girl called Marie who loses her sweetheart in a diving accident, and she rages against God. She says, "I don't believe God exists. If he exists, I hate him. And I shan't stop hating him. If he were standing before me, I'd spit in his face. I'll hate him as long as I live. I shan't forget. I'll hate him until I die." If we treat God like a vending machine, that is where we'll end up when tragedy strikes. We'll be like Marie, we won't be like Job. But amazingly, although Job had passed this test with flying colors, his ordeal is far from over. Satan's not finished. So 2:1 says, again there was a day. So let's look at this second assault. Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. This idea of them presenting themselves to God, it reminds us that God is sovereign. So all these spiritual beings are subservient to God. They have to report to him, to God. So God is sovereign. Verse 2, the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." So it's a rerun, isn't it, of chapter 1, verses 6 to 12. And again, as in that first scene in chapter 1, the Lord praises Job. Verse 3, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Incidentally, notice Satan's goal. Satan's goal is to try to destroy the believer. But as we saw last week, the Lord is proud of Job. The Lord delights in Job. But, and this is the key thing, but you would not conclude that from his circumstances, would you? So looking at his circumstances, at his life, you might conclude that instead of loving him, the Lord hates him, if you just looked at his life. The New York Times ran an article a few years ago called Googling for God. When it comes to questions about God, which people search for on Google, the top three questions people were searching on were, number one, does God exist? Number two, why does God allow suffering? And number three, why does God hate me? Why does God hate me? When things go wrong in life, we instinctively assume that, don't we? That God hates me. Otherwise, why would all this stuff happen? You know, that's why he hasn't given me the success I longed for, or the child, or the spouse, or the happiness, or that is why these things have been taken from me, because God hates me. But if we are in Christ, God loves us. And he delights in us as we seek to follow him. And so we must not try to read into the tea leaves of our circumstances what God thinks of us. Because if we do, we'll get it horribly wrong. So perhaps even at the moment, perhaps you're thinking at the moment, God hates me because this or that has happened in my life. When in fact, he's saying, "You muppet, I love you." Verse 4. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give for his life, but stretch out your hand and touch his bone in his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face. So Satan is saying the first test did not go deep enough. And surprisingly, and it is a surprise, isn't it? Surprisingly, God does not say, no, enough's enough. Job passed the test, push off Satan. Instead, he gives Satan permission again. Verse 6, the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, only spare his life. Scary permission. Now again, remember that Job never hears this conversation. Yeah, Job never hears this conversation. So Job does not know why his life is falling apart. Job does not know that God has allowed Satan to bring suffering to test his faith. And even though we get to listen into this particular conversation, like Job, we don't have all the answers. So we don't get to hear, do we, everything that goes on in heaven. It's not like we have access to the meetings of every heavenly cabinet meeting. We don't. And so we must not expect that everything in our lives is going to make sense in this life. We too may face inexplicable suffering. So in the Bible, we're given some pieces of the jigsaw, but we're not given all of them. As soon as permission is granted, Satan heads out immediately to attack Job. Verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Did you know that Satan has the power to do that? To attack the health of a believer. That's what it says. Satan struck Job with loathsome sores. When you get sick as a believer, what does the Bible say are the possible causes? Well, I can think of three, and maybe there are more, but option one, sickness is just part of living in a fallen world. So 2 Corinthians 4 verse 16 says, our outer nature, speaking of our bodies, our outer nature is wasting away. We get old, we die, sickness is part of this process. You know, somebody after church sneezes all over you, you'll probably get their cold. It's cause and effect. That's option one. Option two, sickness may be God's specific judgment on a believer for some sin. 1 Corinthians 11, verses 29 to 32, is an example of this from the church in Corinth. Option three, sickness is Satan's doing, as it was for Job, allowed by God to test our faith. New Testament examples of this kind of satanic involvement would be things like Luke 13, 10 to 17. It says, a woman who had a disabling spirit for 18 years... Jesus heals her, and then he says that she was a daughter of Abraham whom Satan bound for 18 years. Or Paul says that his thorn in the flesh, he says it was a messenger of Satan to harass me, 2 Corinthians 12. Those are certainly three options I can think of. You maybe will think of more, but how do we know which it is in any given situation? Well, I don't think we do. I don't think we do, but this range of biblical data, it warns us against having a sort of an oversimplistic approach to sickness. So, for some Christians, everything going wrong is the devil. You get a cold, you get cancer, that's the devil. For other Christians, everything is just natural processes, and God and Satan are not on the radar at all. I think this is warning us that we mustn't just seize on one bit of scripture as we think about things like sickness and disease. But the key thing is that we respond as Job did. So verse 9. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Mrs. Job was not a great deal of help in this situation, was she? So what she tells him to do is exactly what Satan wanted him to do. So let's beware being like her or beware listening to people like her. Verse 10, but he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak." That's pretty kind and pretty restrained in the circumstances to respond like that. Even in his suffering, he doesn't lash out at her. He just says, "Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. The bottom line for Job is God is God. He is sovereign. He knows best. He doesn't owe me. And he is worthy of worship, whatever happens, come what may. And the question is, how is it with us? So how do we respond when things do not turn out as we want in our lives? I mean, we are very unlikely to suffer as much as Job did. But will we respond as Job did? Jeremy Marshall is someone we've had on the barge speaking on numerous occasions. I mean, he lost a lot, didn't he? He was a bank CEO, great success, massive income and so on. Overnight, that tumor diagnosis, cancer diagnosis, he loses his job, he loses his health, he even loses his eyesight at one point, goes blind, but he still worships God. It's great to have Shuman finally back with us. What a past year she has had in hospital. What a nightmare with her health. And yet, what steadfast faith in the Lord through it all. Such people have shown themselves to be true believers. Not rice Christians, not vending machine Christians. Their faith has stood the test. And the question is, what about us? Which biblical character would you like to meet, most like to meet, when you get to heaven, apart from Jesus? Which biblical character? I think for me, Job would be up there. Don't you reckon? I'd want to go up to him and say, "Job, respect, mate. I mean, your example, it was an inspiration." Job suffered a lot more than we will, but he still kept his faith and his integrity. And Job knew a lot less than we do, but he still kept his faith and his integrity. I mean, we have a complete Bible. Job did not have this. We got to listen into what was going on in heaven. He didn't. And we live the other side of the coming of Jesus. And Jesus is the ultimate Job, isn't he? I mean, Job foreshadows Jesus in so many ways, and maybe you've been thinking about this already. That, you know, Job was the greatest man of the East, but Jesus, he was the greatest ever. Job was blameless, but Jesus was sinless. Job lost his possessions and his children, but Jesus left heaven and the Father to be born into poverty. Job's wife was not particularly supportive, but Jesus, he was betrayed by one of his closest friends. He was deserted by everyone. Job was covered with sores, but Jesus was flogged and crucified. And like Job, Jesus held fast his love and his trust in God. Jesus is the ultimate example of a righteous man who suffers terribly, but who is dearly loved by God and dearly loves God. And so in the losses that we face in life, let us look to him and let us be like him and like Job who came before him. Well, let's pause for a moment to reflect on this and maybe to pray that in the quietness of our own minds and hearts. And then we're going to continue in prayer together.